Good afternoon. Today, as a special treat for Gay Pride Month, we present In Search of Sappho, an interview with Frances Doughty, a classical scholar, who will talk about Sappho and her work.
And I have asked her to give us some information about Sappho, a poet who has captured a lot of people's imagination, and about what she was like and how she wrote and the problems in getting translations of her work, and maybe why so little of it has survived. Supposing we start off with kind of the legend of Sappho. I mean, all of this nonsense about her throwing herself overboard for a fisherman, which I don't believe for a minute.
Well, the main thing you can say about Sappho is that you don't know very much. Most of the evidence we have about her life comes from her poetry, which is very fragmentary. But in later years, she became an object of some mockery. There are 6 comedies written about her, half of which showed her chasing after women and half of which showed her chasing after men. The facts are not established as such. The only way that you can really make up your mind what you think is by reading what's left of her poetry, I think. She came from a very wealthy family, as far as we can tell. She had several brothers. Was probably born about 630 BC. We say about, because again, there isn't any definite information on when she was born, but we know that she was a contemporary of another poet, a man named Alcaeus, who also lived on Lesbos, who wrote about the political upheavals that were happening then. And we can date those political upheavals, so we figure Sappho was probably somewhere between 20 and 30 when they were going on. She had a mother whom she mentions. She had a daughter whom she mentions. She does not mention a husband in what we have left. She had 3 brothers, one of whom went sailing off to Egypt to sell wine from Lesbos and got involved with a very famous courtesan, and one of her poems is saying, "Oh, I hope you come back soon and don't get mixed up with that woman again." And he's reported to have not cared for that public rebuke. And in her own poetry, there's very little reflection of all this turmoil that was going on. There is mention on a piece of marble that was found on the island of Paros, which has a lot of dates in sequence, that she was exiled to Sicily, to Syracuse, at some point in these political turmoils. And there is one poem that's very scrappy of hers that mentions being in exile and has a phrase in it that's hard to be sure one's understanding right, but seems to say that I'm not able to give you a nice headdress to her little daughter, which sounds as though she may be poor in exile. But that's all that we have that's clear about that, or unclear.
By scrappy, you mean fragmentary.
Yeah. There are only really 2 complete poems left. And even those, one of them is not totally complete. They were quoted by ancient authors. Other ways that we know what she wrote are people who made up dictionaries and kind of encyclopedias, who would put a word in and then say, well, Sappho says in these lines such and such, and then give another word that would clear up this strange word that she'd used. And then, about the end of the 19th century, they started finding a lot of papyrus fragments in Egypt. And that's where a lot of the present body of Sappho's work came from, because...
When was this?
They're called the Oxyrhynchus papyri, and they've been being edited and published gradually, but it started, I think, around 1890.
You mean that it could happen that more poetry of hers could be discovered?
Yeah, I mean, anything could happen, and maybe someday cows will fly, and I hope that this may happen again, but nobody's putting any bets on it. But anyhow, we do have a lot of painfully scrappy pieces the papyri were written in columns, so that sometimes you have half of a line on the left side and then a gap in the middle and another half on the left end, or a dot and a half a letter and then another third of a letter, and some scholar sits there and tries to figure out what should be written in to most fit with the traces. The scrappiness of the poetry is part of the, I think, part of the legend. You know, you have these two almost full poems left, one of which is just very strong statement of emotions and physical responses that have survived through the centuries, and then we have a bit here and a bit there. And I think that adds to the kind of romantic aura about her, you know, lost in the mists of antiquity.
Well, nonetheless, I imagine another thing that would add to the romantic aura would be the comments that other people who knew the full body of her work had made, like Plato.
Well, they're very tantalizing, again. For instance, there's one place when Aristotle quotes a few lines and he says, well, Alcaeus, this poet who was her contemporary on Lesbos, is speaking, but they're written by Sappho. Now, we don't know whether he means Sappho was making up a poem in which she was giving Alcaeus a speech, or whether he wrote a poem that she wrote an answer to, and so forth. Horace didn't think too much of her, the Roman poet. He was said she talked about popular girls, whatever he meant by popular. Ovid was rather fond of her. He said there was nothing more lascivious, which is what it sounds like. Then there's this whole tradition in the comedy of sometimes portraying her as involved in this legendary romance where she threw herself off the cliff, as you said, and others very coarse descriptions of her as a lesbian. And the word lesbian seems to have carried that meaning from fairly early on. There's a poem written later, about a generation after Sappho, by a man who's describing how he's trying to pick up some girl from Lesbos, and he had gray hair, and she didn't really seem too interested because she was hot on the tail of another. And in Greek, the other has a gender, which is feminine in this case. So
I'm wondering about the that comedy. It's fairly common now for people to do bawdy satires about rather popular figures, and sometimes figures who one feels somewhat in awe of. I mean, there's no point in making coarse jests and public satires about somebody who nobody cares about.
Yeah, well, I think that's quite true, and she was not a small figure to any of the ancients, I don't think. She left, that we know of, nine books. Now, a book isn't, in our sense, a book. It's a roll, a volume, we would call it. But still, we know that the first book had something like 330 or 430 four-line stanzas in it, which is, in one book alone, a fair body of poetry. And she wrote songs that seem to have been intended for weddings. There are a few others that are commonly thought of as hers, which may turn out to be folk songs, not even written by her. Then this four-line stanza is named for her, the Sapphic stanza, which is three lines of the same meter and then a little short tag as the fourth line that indicates that the stanza is closing, which was imitated throughout. I mean, even the Latin poets were using that as a meter. So, and it's the first time that it occurs that we know of. So she definitely left a very large stamp. She was quite early in Greek literary history. There was Homer, and there are a few other lyric poets. And Lesbos had, I think, a tradition. At least there are two others that we know of who were named as men who had been earlier poets. And some of the similes she uses, especially talking about young girls, who haven't been married yet, or ones that have carried on throughout Western literary tradition. Well, the flower, the hyacinth, or the apple that's at the top of the bough all red, not because it wasn't a good apple, but because nobody could reach it.
Could you give us an example of that stanza with the tag end?
It's kind of hard to read Greek poetry because it's based on length, not stress. In other words, it's more like a musical beat where you're supposed to hold it. And then the language itself had a pitch accent so that you're supposed to go up and down the way Chinese does. Well, I can't manage all of that, so I'll try to stick to the basic meter. Okay, here's one stanza. Phainatai moi kein osisos theoisen emenoner hotis enantiostoi is danai kai plasion ha juphonesa subakue. That's the end of one stanza. I'll go. Do you want me to go on with this?
Yeah.
Okay, there's three more plus a line. This is fragment 31, probably her most famous piece of writing. Kai galaisas imeroen tomeiman kardian in state thesinep toisen hos gares ido broche hos mephonais uden et eke a lakan men glosae age lepton dautika hroi pur upade dromeken o patesi duden orem epi rhombeis dacuae ca demidros psuchros eche tromos de paison agre chlorotera de poeas emmi tethnacen doligo pideoes phainomai.
And that was read with a shifting, a rising and falling pitch originally, and the length pretty much as you had it there. What does it mean?
Well, this is the poem that Catullus imitated. It's talking about a woman who's sitting next to a man. And it says, I will do a rough translation. That one, that man, seems to me equal to the gods. That one who sits next to you and hears you speaking nearby softly and laughing sweetly. And that makes my heart flutter in my breast. For whenever I see you just for a minute, then I can't talk at all. But my tongue is silent. And right away, a fine fire creeps up under my skin. And I don't see even one thing with my eyes. And my hearing is nothing but loud noises. And a cold sweat pours down me. And a trembling chases all through me. And I'm greener than grass. And I seem to almost be dying. And then there's one tantalizing line that begins another stanza, which we don't have the end of it. But everything must be endured. And that's where it stops.
Yeah, I've been in situations like that. Another straight woman. What makes... See, I don't know anything about the Greek language. What makes the poetry, you know, per se, that highly regarded? You know, was she that much a master of the language? You know, what were the peculiarities of the poetry? Could you compare it to anybody who was written in English?
That's really hard. I've been thinking about that. She doesn't use a lot of imagery. She's not full of similes or metaphors, though there are some that are very telling, like those I was talking about before for the unmarried girls. This poem I just read, for example, really has no imagery at all, but it's such a telling use of adjectives is one thing. And the vividness of the verbs, the heart flutters, the trembling chases through her as in a hunt. The sweat is cold. And they're very simple sentences. There's nothing complex or at all academic. I think it's the directness that gives it a lot of its power. There's another poem in which she talks about feeling like dying, and you assume she's not feeling too good, though it doesn't seem to have been as strong a statement in that poem as it was in the one we just read. And but she goes on to describe the dewy banks of the river of death. There's a lot of flowers, there's a lot of colors, there's a lot of smells and sounds, a lot of very direct appeals to the senses. She talks about a shrine of Aphrodite, where there's you can hear the cold water through the apple boughs, and the altars are full of incense. And it's, I think, that kind of very specific detail that gives her power.
Was that poem that you read before one of the two nearly complete ones?
Yeah. This is a poem in which she asks Aphrodite to come help her. And I'll read the translation that Mr. Page has written in the edition I'm using to read from. He says, "Richly enthroned immortal Aphrodite, daughter of Zeus, weaver of wiles, I pray to you. Break not my spirit, lady, with heartache or anguish." It somehow sounds much more homely in the Greek. "Don't rebuke me with scoldings or blames, lady. But hither come, if ever in the past you heard my cry from afar and marked it and came, leaving your father's house, your golden chariot yoked, sparrows beautiful and swift conveyed you," those sparrows, I always loved them, "with rapid wings aflutter above the dark earth from heaven through the midair. And soon they were come, and you, fortunate, with a smile on your immortal face, asked what ails me now, and why am I calling now, and what in my heart's madness I most desire to have. Whom now must I persuade to join your friendship's ranks? Who wrongs you, Sappho? For if she flees, she shall soon pursue. And if she receives not gifts, yet shall she give. And if she loves not, she shall soon love even against her will. Come to me now also, and deliver me from cruel anxieties. Fulfill all that my heart desires to fulfill, and be yourself my comrade in arms." I want to say one thing about this translation, that stanza, "For if she flees, she shall soon pursue," and so forth. In Greek, you can have a third-person verb without any pronoun, in other words, no indication of gender. And in the original, it's simply that, and various translators have said "if he" or "if she," depending on their interpretations of the poem, but there's no evidence one way or another in this specific poem. You have to take it from your own feelings about Sappho. And her name is mentioned. In Aeolic, it was Sappho with a ps sound.
Well, we don't know, how the original sounded, or do
we? No, well, it's spelt differently than S.
No, I mean, for instance, the way you read it, I'm wondering if originally the pronunciation was, is there any indication of what the original Greek sounded like? Like, you know, for instance, if I were reading Old English, we make assumptions from...
We make very large assumptions. Erasmus is the person who formed the foundation for our present pronunciation. As with Latin, where the Italians think he should pronounce it like Italian, the modern Greeks think he should pronounce ancient Greek like modern Greek. And this is not 100% accurate to even what we know. It's a kind of formalistic effort.
In other words, some way of regularizing it.
Yeah, the standard thing that you learn in school if you go to somebody who went to the school that taught it that way.
I guess there never will be a way of finding it out. That poem has meant a lot to me, too.
And one other thing I wanted to mention is amongst these scraps, there are the names of really quite a number of women. We have some that are enemies and some that are friends. There's one very sweet one where she says, "I was in love with you, Athos, a long time ago, once upon a time. And you were a little child then, and not very charming." And we guess that Athos has gone off to somewhere else. And then there's a woman she didn't like named Andromeda, who kept taking people away from her, one assumes. And there are about five or six or seven other people, women that she mentions. And she talks about love, the limb looser, once again, the sweet bitter, the one thing you can't do anything about, the creeping creature is whirling me around. And then another one, love shakes my spirits or my heart like a wind blowing down the mountain trees. And another one, you came, I was raging after you. You cooled my heart that was burning with desire. Well, coupling that with the first poem I read, and there are other fragments that are similar to this, I don't see why people have such trouble thinking that Sappho was a lesbian, but they do. I'd like to quote Mr. Page, one last note.
Well, this reminds me that my English teacher in college told me that there are quite a number of people in English departments around the country who consistently refuse to believe that Walt Whitman was homosexual.
Well, it's much nicer that way. For all those English teachers in high schools around the country. He's been talking, destroying evidence that Sappho was ever a school teacher or leader of a chorus to the Muses or any of the other stories that have been made up, especially in the 19th century, to whitewash her. So, he says that it's futile to deny that Sappho had those tendencies. To the further question, so often propounded, I'm quoting now, so seldom considered without evidence, without prejudice, whether evidence for practice as well as inclination is to be found in the fragments of Sappho's poetry, a negative answer must be returned. It is at least probable that Lesbos in her lifetime was notorious for the perverse practices of its women. But in all that remains of Sappho's poetry, there is not a word which connects herself or her companions with them, and at most half a word which reveals her awareness of their existence. And by half a word, he literally means that. At the beginning of one papyrus, there is a thing which can be restored to read the first five letters of the Greek word for dildo.
Oh, you've got to be kidding. But, I mean, I've written a lot of poetry that isn't, you know, particularly sexually explicit, but, you know, oh, come on. She has to sit down and say, I went to bed with so-and-so at such a time. Are you our now, or were you ever, and where were you on the night of the 17th? And that's the kind of tenor that people take in these things. They have to have absolute proof. But if she'd written poetry about men...
Well, yeah. I mean, there have been all sorts of... Well, not all sorts, but there have been attempts to take that poem where she talks about the man who is like to the god because he hears the woman's voice, and it's definitely a woman's voice because it's a feminine gender, and somehow turn it around so it's the man that is really shaking her up. It's really bothered people a lot, and very fine scholars have done their best to deny what seems to me fairly clear, not evidence, but indications of physical attractions to women. All men, of course.
Do you think that's why we only have two full poems left?
I don't really know about that. One of the things that did make for survival was to be the sort of person that the monks wanted to copy. But it also may have happened that some of Sappho's poems were lost before that. I don't know if when precisely they started to dwindle and vanish. There was a large library in Alexandria that got burned down in Caesar's time, but Roman poets coming later seem to have known of Sappho's writings complete, so I don't know.
Seems to me they would have more than one library.
Yeah, they did. And I've never remember reading any clear statement about when they got lost.
Well, I guess my feeling, my personal feeling about that, though I'm certainly no scholar, would be that for the same reason that people persist in denying the accomplishments of all sorts of women and denying the existence of all sorts of warrior queens, that are mentioned in the works of antiquity. And in denying that Sappho actually practiced all sorts of perverse practices. I mean, you'd have to be some hell of a woman to survive that as much as she did.
Yeah, it's kind of a magic to me that this voice, and however much of it is left, has come down. So it's 600 plus 1973 is 2,500 years, which is a long time.
And those poems still
speak to us.
Yeah, they still touch my heart,
right.
Like a windstorm.
We don't even know what really set Sappho off, but she was living in a time of great expansion and excitement. She had, as I said, her brother went to Egypt, then one of her women friends, I will call them not to offend any classical scholars in the audience, went off to Lydia, which is in Asia Minor. She was traveling around herself, perhaps, and it was a kind of explosive time in the history of Lesbos. The whole governmental structure was changing. There was a whole poetry going on. One of her insults to somebody who's, she says she hopes that she just dies and goes down there, because she's not somebody who's touched by the muses. And so there seems to have been, even within Sappho's home circle of women friends, certain poetic activity, none of which has survived, but she must have been living a very exciting life.
Sort of like being a movement media star these days.
Well, I don't know what movement there was. The media was word of mouth, but vaguely, yeah.
Getting invites to read her poetry around or something.
Oh, it's nice to think of it like that.
That was Frances Doughty speaking on the works of Sappho and the search for the meaning and history of her poetry. The program was produced by Martha Shelley.